These are African rhythms, passed down to us through ancient spirits. Feel the spirit, a unifying force. Come on, move with the spirit. Stand up, clap your hands. Move with the rhythms, get down.
From WSNC 90.5 FM, a broadcasting service and NPR affiliate of Winston-Salem State University, welcome to Africa World Now Project. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. Today, we look at the role and continued struggle of the National Union of Eritrean Women with the Secretary of the National Union of Eritrean Women, USA. Africa World Now Project is next. The history of the geographical region, which now is called Eritrea, is rich. While it would be a mistake to define this history within the imposition of the nation-state, the creation of the state of Eritrea, the reverberation of external forces across the region as well as the continent has presented us with a narrative that suggests much of this history was dominated by wars against invaders since the 16th century. Eritrea has been occupied in turn by Ottoman Turks, Egyptians, Italians from 1886 until 1941, the British until 1952 who defeated Italy and Eritrea during the Second World War, and the Ethiopians ever since. In 1952, the British and the United Nations determined a federation of Eritrea and Ethiopia. This, of course, was carried out without any consideration of the wishes of the people, nor the strong Muslim opposition, notwithstanding the majority of Eritreans who were against the forming of a federation. In the first 10 years after the federation was formed, Ethiopia's direct rule over Eritrea was imposed. Towards the end of 1952, the Voice of Eritrea, a newspaper critical of the federation, was banned. In 1956, following the suppression of the opposition waged by workers and the peasantry, the Eritrean General Union of Labor Syndicates was banned. In 1960, the Eritrean flag was lowered and separate courts were established. In 1962, Eritrea was forcibly annexed by Ethiopia. The national struggle for liberation began in 1961 with the formation of the Eritrean Liberation Front. The ELF and the Eritrean People's Liberation Front, EPLF, which split from the LEF in 1970, gained control over many towns in the country. But as the Soviet Union intervened on the Ethiopian behalf, independence could not be achieved until the late 1970s. The Soviet Union's intervention forced withdrawal from the towns that were controlled by the EPLF to the northern part of the country. The EPLF continued fighting against the Ethiopian occupation until it liberated the whole of Eritrea in May 1991. Eritrea became an independent country officially in May 1993. Important to this brief historical overview is the roles Eritrean women played in the national liberation movement. During this period, their contributions and roles were transformed. Some estimates suggest that women made up about 30 to 35% of the Liberation Army, while thousands more were organized into a union, the National Union of Eritrean Women, where they fought on all fronts. It has been suggested that although women in many countries have struggled together with men for national liberation, at the end of that revolutionary struggle, their position in society as women improves little as the era dawns. While this view is correct in one sense, it forgets the objective reality of the stages of socioeconomic and political development of formerly colonized nations. There are many contradictions embedded in the structure, systems, and institutions between the people and the colonizers, between the different liberation movements that led the National Liberation Front, and between the different classes. As a consequence, national liberation does not mean that all contradictions are going to be solved in one go. It is here that Fanon and Cabral add sharp clarity to the pitfalls of national consciousness without the implementation of class suicide. And quite frankly, a commitment to the processes of and the interdependence of decolonial and anti-colonial praxis, where decolonial is the struggle to remove the material systems, structures, and institutions, while anti-colonial is the protracted process of negating the reconsolidation of colonial logic. The struggle for national liberation can only solve the primary contradiction at the particular time it is developed. Women's struggle for freedom cannot be seen in isolation from the larger struggle for liberation. Today, we will hear a talk that was given by Secretary of the National Union of Eritrean Women USA, member of the Central Committee, and member of the National Public Diplomacy Task Force. Our show is produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descendant communities at Standing Rock, Venezuela, Corporation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, Brazil, the Avalon Village in Detroit, Colombia, Kenya, Palestine, South Africa, Ghana, Haiti, and other places who are fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all peoples. Listen intently, think deeply, act accordingly. Enjoy the program.
جينا بعيش ليت فليا مسأل يا سينا تقديرا ويش أكين اللي بحر كبدا أفريقا 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 قبل بيسفرا.
I come from cornfields and mustard greens, cowbells and cowrie shells, high lands and Red Sea waters. I come from the land of Netzalas. I come from the land of Habeshas, the birthplace of Niles, of diverse cultures, harmony of religions, hospitality and kindness. I come from the land of Nubians. I come from war zones and refugee camps, changing times and tormenting nights, selfless sacrifices and stubborn hopes. I come from messages like, if there's a will, there's always a way. My share of self-reliance and victory to the masses. I come from government assistance and project housings, night schools and odd jobs, homemade dresses and school ground teasings, alternative schools and ESL classes. I come from local communities with far away families. I come from the world of immigrants, role reverse realities, foreign entities, broken dignities, shifting grounds. I come from new opportunities. I come from college dorms and top ramen noodles, multicultural circles and potluck meals. My contribution, coffee ceremonies, visas, passports, and transnational identities. I come from borderlands. I live in borderlands. And that's just an idea of, like, you know, the Eritrean story that has gone global. So I would like to introduce our presenter for today. She'll be sharing with us the history of the National Union of Eritrean Women, as well as some examples of the atrocities and the challenge that women and children have endured throughout that struggle. Her name is Sevle Tsahaye. She's the secretary for the National Union of Eritrean Women USA. She's also a member of the Central National Union of Eritrean Women's Central Committee, as well as the, a member of the National Public Diplomacy Task Force. So without further ado, I introduce to you Sevle.
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much, Comrade Mohret, for that introduction. Thank you, Sister Cha, for making this happen, and for all our co-sponsors who made this presentation today possible. It's dialogue is a great way to get to know one another. So hopefully, after my brief presentation, we can get into an interesting question and answer period. So, please take this with a grain of salt. The other day, last week, I was meeting with someone. We were talking, somebody who has been elected to work as a representative of the U.S. government in certain parts of the Eritrea situation. And he was telling me that before he was elected to work on Eritrea, he had no idea or never heard about Eritrea. He said after his election, though, or his appointment, you know, he researched a lot, and he has since learned a lot about Eritrea. I just wanted to give some context to our conversation. So I just want to start briefly with what Eritrea is about. And as you can see, I have a little saying right below the title. Eritrea believes in self-determination, and fostering positive and engaged partnerships for growth and development. So with that being said, let's talk about Eritrea. Eritrea is found in the Horn of Africa. It has Sudan, Ethiopia, Djibouti as bordering countries, and Saudi Arabia and Yemen share maritime borders with Eritrea. As you can see, we're located right at the Red Sea with the Suez Canal above us, and this is a very big and significant trade route for global economy. Eritrea's coastline consists of over 1,000 kilometers along the Red Sea, as well as over 1,000 kilometers of island coastlines that are in the Red Sea. The capital city of Eritrea is Asmara. Asmara has been designated a heritage city by the United Nations. The population is approximately 5.5 million. Eritrea was formerly an Italian colony. Until the end of World War II, and at that point, it fell under the British administration. After the British administration, at the completion of the British administration, it was unjustifiably federated with Ethiopia in 1947. The federation was a decision made at the United Nations, and it was done for the benefit of the interests of others and not the interest of Eritrea. After World War II, all of the colonized nations or the colonized areas, with the exception of two, Eritrea being one, were given independence. Unfortunately, Eritrea's fate fell on the hands of those who wanted to hold Eritrea in their interest, and so they federated Eritrea with Ethiopia. And 5 years after the federation, Ethiopia illegally annexed Eritrea, making it a province of Ethiopia. So in 1961, the struggle for independence started. It was an armed struggle. The first shots were fired against the occupying troops by the Sudanese border in Eritrea. And so that marks our start of the fight for freedom. The struggle lasted for 30 years. It was a bitter struggle. It was Eritrean freedom fighters against a mechanized military, one of the biggest and largest military in Africa, the Ethiopian military at that time. And they were supported, you know, first by the United States. And when United States and Ethiopia relationships faltered with the change of the Ethiopian monarchy and the government changed to the Ethiopian government became a communist country, the partnership in Ethiopia was with Russia. So Ethiopia had first the support of United States and then the support of Russia in its fight or war, their war, our struggle for Eritrean independence. We lost a lot of Eritrean lives in our fight and struggle for independence. Or there isn't an Eritrean who doesn't have a family member that hasn't lost a brother, a sister, a father, a mother, you know, a child to Ethiopia, to Eritrean independence. And then in 2008, which I'll be mentioning later, in 1998 and 2000 to 2000, in the fight to keep Eritrean sovereignty in the second war with Ethiopia. In 1991, after the struggle for independence, Eritrea was liberated by the Eritrean People's Liberation Front, EPLF. And then in 1993, there was a referendum that was organized with international observers. 98.5% of Eritreans voted in the referendum, and 99.8% of those who voted for independence, thus creating the sovereign Eritrea in 1993, May 24th, 1993. And every May 24th, we celebrate our Independence Day. Eritrea is home of diverse communities, almost equally divided between Christians and Muslims. We have 9 ethnic groups, and you can see from the picture there. Because of the time limit that we have, I won't go into the details. But for anybody who'd like to have me share the presentation, I can do that after we are done today. What you see up top is the Eritrean flag. The Eritrean flag consists of 4 colors: green, red, yellow, and blue. There is a meaning to our flag. The red, as you can see, the triangle goes from a wider angle to a narrower angle. That means that represents the blood that was shed for the struggle for during the struggle for independence. And the fact that it's going from a wide angle to a narrow angle indicates the promise and the commitment to ensure that no more bloodshed for Eritrea. The green, as you can see, goes from a narrow angle to a wide angle. It represents the agricultural resources of Eritrea during the time of Ethiopian domination or annexation. We didn't, as Eritreans, have the right to use our resources and to decide and manage our resources as we see fit. And it was managed and overseen by others. So the green on our map, on our flag now, represents that we will manage our resources, the green again meaning the agricultural resources, and that it goes from not being used to being, you know, fully utilized, and ensuring that there's full participation from all Eritreans. The blue represents the water resources of Eritrea, and because it was not utilized during the time of the struggle, the angle goes from a narrow to a wide angle. The yellow wreath in the center, yellow representing the color of peace and the desire of peace for Eritrea and Eritreans. As you see the wreath, there are nine leaves on the right side and the left side. So the nine leaves represent on the right side the nine ethnic groups, and the nine leaves on the left side represent the nine languages spoken by our nine ethnic groups, because they are distinct to their own groups. The wreaths also have 30 leaves, and those 30 leaves represent the 30 years of struggle that Eritrea had to overcome for independence. So that is the meaning of our flag. So that was I just wanted to give you a quick information about Eritrea. The next topic is the National Union of Eritrean Women. National Union of Eritrean Women was established in November of 1979 during the struggle for independence. The EPLF was a believer in ensuring women's rights and women's participation in all aspects of social, political, economic spheres of the country and of the struggle. So with the support of the EPLF, the National Union of Eritrean Women was established in the fields. The women fighters represented 30% of the freedom fighters of the EPLF, and they were active combatants. So they fought equally with their counterparts, the Eritrean men, with their brothers. And the motto was equality through equal work. So emancipation through active participation in the social revolution is the vision that started the National Union of Eritrean Women. The mission of the National Union of Eritrean Women is to ensure that all Eritrean women confidently stand for their rights and equally participate in the political, economic, social, and cultural spheres of the country and share their benefits. The National Union of Eritrean Women is headquartered in Asmara in Eritrea, the capital city. And you see there a picture of the headquarters. That's one of our beautiful architecturally designed buildings in Asmara. It has a global network and footprints in Africa, Middle East, Europe, North America, and Australia. In Africa, we have representation other than Eritrea in Sudan. In the Middle East, we have representation in Saudi Arabia. In Europe, they're all over Europe. We're all over Europe in England, in Italy, in Switzerland, in Norway, in Sweden, in And I think I mentioned Italy already. And in North America, we are here in the United States and also in Canada. Our global membership numbers tends to be around 350,000, a little over 350,000 at last count. In the diaspora, we have 4,500. In the United States, we are at about 900 members strong. So the, like we said, the mission for the National Union of Eritrean Women is to ensure gender equality and women's rights in the political, economic, and social, sociocultural spheres. The National Union of Eritrean Women has been very active in the grassroots level, not just impacting women's lives, but lives of Eritreans in Eritrea. One of the things that Eritrean women have been very successful in is the grassroots activities that they have done. During the struggle for independence, Eritrean women who were fighters would go into the villages and, you know, dressed in village clothing so that they wouldn't be seen by the Ethiopian soldiers, and talked to the villagers and teach the villagers. They would teach them about, you know, how to read to ensure that literacy is one of the goals of Eritrea as a whole, and ensuring that women could read and write was one of the biggest challenges that they faced during the struggle for independence. So while the struggle for independence was going on, in parallel to that, there were social campaigns that were happening in the villages of Eritrea. And a lot of that was handled by the National Union of Eritrean Women. They would increase women's social awareness and knowledge. They wanted to have women who were, you know, not freedom fighters, but were, you know, living in the villages, be part of the movement and part of the decision-making process. They was in the endeavor for the active participation of Eritrean women in the overall development programs was another mission, and then to strengthen the union and to make it more efficient and influential, and enable it to win the loyalty and confidence of its members. And that way you also get new members. You get, you know, you increase the memberships through that as well. And these missions or these goals and aims, although they started during the struggle for independence, and they continued post-independence and post-sovereign Eritrea as well. There's a lot to talk about with regards to what Eritrea has, or the National Union of Eritrean Women has accomplished. So I've just picked out a few highlights because, again, you know, I know you're here on Sunday afternoon. A lot of people are busy, so I don't want to take, you know, 3-4 hours going through the accomplishments or the history of the National Union of Eritrean Women. So I've picked a couple of things that would highlight what the National Union of Eritrean Women is all about. The picture that you see here is Mama Zainab. Mama Zainab is a poet and also a freedom fighter. She is one of the iconic heroines of the Eritrean struggle for independence. She also is a woman who fought very hard to ensure that women had a voice in Eritrea, to ensure that there were underage marriages, FGM was abolished and eradicated. And she told the story through a lot of her poetry. So that's why I wanted to share her picture. You know, she's one of my favorite heroines, and I like to talk about her. So one of the main accomplishments of the National Union of Eritrean Women is empowering women's decision-making. Eritrea is a very patriarchal society, the culture. So going beyond that and being allowing the culture to sort of eradicate those inhibitions that we have as women, and for that, you know, patriarchal society to let go of its restrictions has been a long battle. And the National Union of Eritrean Women is one of the mechanisms by which that has been fought. So the inclusion of women in centers of political power, particularly in legislative and executive bodies, to ensure elimination of bias and inequality is one of the things that NUI has worked on. And when I say NUI, by the way, it stands for, it's N-U-E-W, the acronym for National Union of Eritrean Women. There is an established policy of for a third of seats to be reserved for women candidates in leadership position. So it is the expectation of the population that in Eritrea, if we have, 20 leaders in a company or what have you, a third of those seats has to be for women candidates. We see that in our leadership, in our ministerial posts, we have more than a third of the seats held by women. Though women's representation remains low today, however, tangible improvements have been made and are also being observed right now in our executive and judiciary branches. We see a lot of female judges and female attorneys that have come to serve in the Eritrean judiciary branch. Alongside its efforts to evaluate progress in women's representation, NUI provides gender-sensitive seminars, workshops, campaigns, and trainings, and developed national strategies and action plans for advancing gender mainstreaming in both public and private sectors. And when I say that, it sounds very easy to do because in context, when we're thinking about the trainings that are happening, the campaigns and the seminars and the workshops that are being held, we may think it's being held in Asmara. But all of the things that are happening are not just happening in Asmara, but all over Eritrea. So when a National Union of Eritrean Women representative is going to teach in, the northern part of Eritrea by the Red Sea in the northern Red Sea region, the roads may not be, paved. Transportation may not come easily. So they may even have to walk, miles and miles to get to a village where they need to provide training and provide workshops. But this is done without question, and it's done with such passion and commitment. The last study that we had done in 2016, in a period of, 5 years, there were over 1.7 million participants in seminars and workshops that were done and coordinated by the National Union of Eritrean Women. So the impact that the National Union is doing for women's ability to have a seat in the decision-making process of the country has been invaluable and very significant. And we see women in all specters of the Eritrean investment pool, whether it is, in banking, in entrepreneurship, in tourism. We have representatives in all aspects of leadership in Eritrea. The other a point I wanted to also talk about is the empowerment that has been made through economics. And mainly I wanted to speak about the credit program. In 2006, NUI introduced a microcredit program for the women of Eritrea. And it is used to empower women to start their own business. And they target women with potential that, they see. And again, when I talk about this, don't visualize it in terms of women in a city. These are women in villages that are very far removed from city life. So they may be farmers, they may be, wives of farmers and who have not done any type of work on their own before. But these women are provided a microcredit, and they're also provided with professional training for the type of business that they would like to do. in from 2006 until 2016 was the last report that we had over 47 million NACFA had been loaned out to about 12,000 beneficiaries. A majority of those benefits loans have been paid back by the women, and not only have they been paid back, but the women have also built their businesses upon other businesses. So they, they've created chicken farms, they've created fruit farms, they've created arts and crafts businesses. So they would, for example, make baskets or, the traditional baskets and arts and crafts. And also the National Union of Eritrean Women would make markets available for them in cities. So they would help them transport their product to the major cities in Eritrea so that they could find buyers for the supply that they had. Women have registered successes, like I said, in small trades, business, agriculture, animal rearing, and as well as the catering sector. The third achievement that I wanted to highlight is establishing professional training centers. With that comes the mobilization of Eritrean women in the diaspora. So the National Union of Eritrean Women in Eritrea has a very strong relationship and very active relationship with Eritrean women in the diaspora. And like I had shown you before, where the representations are, it's in Europe, it's in Africa, Australia, Canada, United States. So the women in the diaspora got together and they mobilized resources and raised funds to build these training centers that you see here. And the training centers are, again, not built in Asmara or another main capital or another main city or big city in Eritrea, but they're usually built in areas where it can be made accessible to women in the rural areas. On the left side, what you see there on the pictures, the small pictures, the top picture is in Barentu, which is a town in the southwest of Eritrea. Then it's Tio, and then we have Karen and Mendefera. The big picture that you see here, I made it big because this is the training center in the southern region of Eritrea. It's in a city called Senafe, and it was built by the funds for the building was raised by the women, the National Union of Eritrean Women here in the United States. And I'm showing you the mountain so that you can see that this isn't in a city environment. It is in a rural area. So the National Union of Eritrean Women abroad have mobilized resources and raised funds to build professional training centers and offices for their sisters in Eritrea. And these efforts are aimed mainly, like I said, at rural areas in line with the national development priorities. And they're grounded in the National Union of Eritrean Women's commitment to social justice. The fourth item I wanted to talk about is legal rights and the support of supporting women in legal empowerment. NUE provides legal counseling and education programs for women so that the knowledge of legal issues is increased. And NUE has fought against discrimination against women and provides legal support in underage marriage. The legal age for marriage is 18 in Eritrea. This was changed post-independence. The support that we have from the government of Eritrea is undeniable and significant. So all the changes that we see in the legal system that impacts women has been done with the support of the government of Eritrea through campaign efforts and mobilization of the National Union of Eritrean Women as well. In addition to underage marriage, we have seen changes in divorce laws, including alimony and paternity, giving women the right to divorce and the right to settlement, as well as the right to get paternity tests for child care. The big change that we see also in the laws of Eritrea is in inheritance and land ownership laws. Like I said before, Eritrea is a very was a very patriarchal system and culture. However, now the laws have changed to ensure that women have the same rights. So in the past, there were areas in Eritrea where women would not could not inherit from parents or could not own land in the village that they came from. However, now women and men equally can have can own land as well as have rights to all inheritance equally without question. The other things that have changed is with the bride price. You know, we've seen this in many societies across the world as well. You know, when women get married, there's a bride price put up that creates a hindrance to the family of the woman, of the girl, as well as dowries create a burden on the family of the girl. And in Eritrea, this has been prohibited. The other thing I wanted to also highlight, like I said, these are highlights because if we were to talk about everything, we'll be here for a very long time. The campaigning for women's health. National Union of Eritrean Women took a very, very active, significant role in ensuring that there was a strong campaign against female genital mutilation. NUI worked closely with the Ministry of Health in Eritrea and other partners as well, to ensure that women were aware and their awareness was raised with regards to health issue and to prevent and treat any type of health challenges that confront women and are caused by poverty and backward traditions. FGM has, I've put up a table, if you can see it, it might be a little too small, but there was a mapping done by the Ministry of Health for the 2018 reporting that was done for the United Nations Development Foundation. And as you can see from 2010 to 2016, 2018, the FGM practices for children under the ages of 15 went from 33.2% to 3.8%. This is a significant decrease. And for those under the age of 5, it went from 12.4% to 1%. Which is another significant decrease, and this is what we would like to see. The National Union of Eritrean Women's campaign against female genital mutilation was initiated to sensitize the society on the adverse effects of FGM on women. Efforts included raising awareness about women's and children's rights and reproductive health, as well as sensitizing traditional circumcisers on the dangerous consequences of FGM. Again, I want to remind you, when we're picturing these campaigns and the trainings, this is not done in the city level. These are done in urban, non-urban rural areas, places where it's very difficult to get to, where it might be very hot and the climate works against you. However, representatives of the National Union of Eritrean Women did not stop them. Nothing stopped them. They reached every village where there had issues or concerns of FGM practices. And through those efforts, they were able to bring down those percentages as you see down there. So going from 33% to 3% in a 6-year span is an amazing feat. And going from 12% to 1% is another amazing feat. So for those who are under the age of 5, we're almost, you know, getting to eradicate FGM, and that is what we want to do. So vigorous efforts have been made to extend FGM campaigns across the entire country and eradicate FGM practices. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the war on Eritrea, and then, you know, we'll tie it back to NUI. When I start the segment, I'm asking two questions, and not so that somebody can give me an answer, but so we can think about this and ponder these two questions as we continue the presentation and hopefully the discussions after the presentation is complete. So my two questions here, or my thoughts, are, can an African nation determine her own future? And number two, can an African nation create her own development plan? So the 1998 war on Eritrea, from 1998 until 2018, so for a couple of decades, Eritrea was diverted from its development path by the war with Ethiopia that started in 1998. In May of 1998, there was a border conflict that started in the town of Badme between Ethiopia and Eritrea. Ethiopia claimed Badme to be its belonging to Ethiopia, and Eritrea claimed it to be an Eritrean town. There was a border skirmish. There were discussions happening between the two governments. However, while the discussions were happening, Ethiopia declared war on Eritrea, and a full-out war encompassed the area. And at the same time, Ethiopia deported Eritreans from Ethiopia. These were Eritreans or Ethiopians of Eritrean origin who had lived in Ethiopia for many, many years, many, many decades. Over 85,000 Eritreans were aggressively and violently expelled from Ethiopia right in 1998. They were taken to the borders between Ethiopia and Eritrea, and they were actually picked up, most of them, in the middle of the night from their homes. No warning was given. They were put on trucks, driven to the border, and just dropped off, and sometimes dropped off in the middle of a war zone. After the 1998 war, in 2000, there was a ceasefire. And a boundary commission reached a unanimous, a peace agreement was signed in 2000 in Algiers. And that peace agreement allowed for a boundary commission to decide on the war results. So that basically who was at fault and who did Badme belong to. But in 2002, the commission reached a verdict. And its decision was unanimous that Badme is in Eritrea, along with other items. That was the decision rendered. However, Ethiopia would not accept that decision and decided that they were not going to accept the binding decision as they had signed in the peace agreement in 2000. So the commission, because Ethiopia did not accept the final and binding decision, even though the OAU, the EU, UN and US were witnesses and guarantors of that agreement, nothing was done. Ethiopia was not held accountable until 2000. The final decision was given. The war technically stopped between the two nations. However, it was sort of they call it a no war, no peace period. However, there was no peace and there was a silent war and there was an economic war that was against Eritrea. And then in 2009, sanctions were placed against Eritrea. The UN Security Council, under the pressure of the US and in collaboration with Ethiopia, imposed sanctions on Eritrea. They imposed sanctions on arms embargo, travel bans, freezing assets of certain Eritrean individuals who were part of the government. All of these sanctions were based on unsubstantiated and false claims that Eritrea has supported the Somali Islamist rebels. In 2012, though, the United Nations Monitoring Group did a report, and the report stated that it found no evidence that Eritrea had at all supported al-Shabaab. Regardless of that finding, they still kept the sanctions intact, and the sanctions were not lifted and they were not removed at all. So, the question might be, there are sanctions and why, what impact does that make? Because this is an arms embargo or a travel ban, but that's open to interpretation. When they say an arms embargo, it's not just, your weapons, but it's also, if you want to bring in a truck, you want to build roads, you want to bring in cement, you're told, that could be utilized for war activities and you're not allowed. So sanctions do not work unless the goal of the sanction is destruction. And we've seen this not just in Eritrea, We've seen it in other nations where sanctions have been placed upon them, where actually countries have crumbled because of the sanctions that have been placed against them. So the sanctions were lifted in November 2018. However, the damage of the sanctions are real. You know, when you're trying to build roads, when you're trying to build schools, when you're trying to get equipment for schools, you're trying to get equipment for medical services and improving your health services to your citizens, it's real. And the victims of the sanctions, although it's Eritreans overall, the biggest victims are women and children. When it comes to health services, when it comes to education services, we're already so far back, and we have a long way to catch up to. It's difficult when you have sanctions in place against a nation. And again, sanctions do not work at all. In 2018. Eritrea, Ethiopia signed a peace agreement. So we want to say African solutions for African problems. So in July 2018, Eritrea and Ethiopia signed a peace agreement. The growth and development strategy was based on cooperation and mutual respect. And peace and stability in the region was the foundation for growth and development was the ideology behind the peace agreement. Eritrea and Ethiopia should have been commended for ending years of conflict and to work peacefully together towards prosperity. I should mention here, in April of 2018, Ethiopia had a new prime minister. That was the reason for the changes that came about in the relationship between Eritrea and in Ethiopia. I have pictures here. They're so significant. As you can see, it says welcoming PIA. PIA is President Isaias Afwerki. And this is a picture of the crowd that was welcoming him in Addis Ababa in Ethiopia. And then welcoming PMAA is Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed. And this was the crowd in Asmara welcoming Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed. Both happened in 2018. And these were historical points in our history. For the first time, there was a peaceful welcome by the people of Eritrea and Ethiopia for the people of Eritrea and Ethiopia. The Eritrea and Ethiopia peace agreement had a lot of supporters, but it also had a lot of enemies to it. You know, we have a lot of what I referred to and a lot of people referred to as conflict entrepreneurs. There are a lot of people who want to make sure that we have conflict in this world because that's how they make their money. It's to sustain their own interest and their own flow of finances or assets or what have you. So those people came in droves to make sure that this peace agreement didn't survive or didn't work. However, the peace agreement is still intact. And also Somalia had also signed in to a tripartite peace agreement. So in the Horn of Africa, Ethiopia, Eritrea, and Somalia have a peace agreement and a cooperation agreement signed. And they want to work together towards a peaceful, harmonious Horn of Africa where they can work towards development and work towards getting, you know, Eritreans, Ethiopians, Somalians out of poverty. Just a couple of points on current situation in the Horn. In 2020, of November 2020, there was conflict that erupted in Ethiopia's northern region of Tigray. The Tigray leadership is the TPLF is the Tigray leadership. The TPLF launched attacks on the Ethiopia's northern command, killing the Ethiopian federal forces. Soon thereafter, TPLF bombed the Eritrean capital of Asmara and other targets in Eritrea. They sent 22 missiles into Eritrea without any provocation. Eritrea did not do anything. TPLF sent their rockets under the suspicion, I guess they assumed Eritrea may respond in kind and the conflict would become a regional conflict. However, Eritrea made a very deliberate decision to remain restrained and did not get involved in retaliatory actions towards the TPLF. However, Eritrea did take measures to ensure and secure her borders through appropriate coordination with the government of Ethiopia. When the TPLF attacked the Ethiopia's Northern Command, that left a vacuum in the border of Ethiopia and Eritrea. And in an area where, you know, you have a lot of sensitivity to terrorism, you want to make sure that you've got a safe and secure border area. So Eritrea, with discussions and coordinations with the government of Ethiopia, took over the border security in Ethiopia and Eritrea. And then Eritrea, in agreement and collaboration also with the Ethiopian government, when it came time to remove their forces, did so and implemented the withdrawal of her forces. On June 28 of 2021, the Ethiopian government, a lot has gone on since, and I'm just, this is a very quick synopsis. There's a lot of information out there, but this is a very, very brief synopsis of what has happened since November 2020. In June of 2021, Ethiopia, the Ethiopian government declared a ceasefire and recanted their soldiers out of Tigray. However, the TPLF representative was out on media and clearly rejected the ceasefire and actually made a promise to continue into its military action into Addis Ababa, as well as threatened to take its forces into Eritrea. There have been also reports in the media. There's been a narrative that has been made against Eritrea. This happened after the 1998 war between Ethiopia and Eritrea. The narrative that was created against Eritrea was very dark. Everywhere we turned, everybody, all the media, the mainstream media, the Western powers were not friendly to Eritrea. And I'm saying that in a very nice and diplomatic way. They attacked Eritrea. They wanted to make sure that Eritrea didn't survive. They did not want this nation that came about through self-determination, that was building its country on its own design, by its own creation of development programs, without loans, without the benefit, or without asking for assistance, but asking for partnership. There were powers that did not want to see this country succeed. And there were powers, including the Ethiopian government at that time under the TPLF leadership. There was a design for regime change strategy for Eritrea. So when the peace agreement was signed in 2018, we thought we had, you know, we were done with all of that, the negativity and the negative narrative that had been placed. And so we thought there was going to be better change coming. However, that hasn't changed. So we still experience the negative narrative that is being created, not just against Ethiopia now, but it continues against Eritrea as well. And one of the things that we've been hearing, and it's been put out in the media, is that the reports is that Eritrean forces have been responsible for genocide and human rights abuses and violations and theft. There has been no evidence that has been provided for these serious allegations. Especially the allegation of genocide is a very serious allegation, and it's not something that you debate on social media. When you have an allegation of genocide, you have to have your international courts involved. And there has not been a proper investigation that has been put in place for this allegation. There have been alleged witnesses that have spread media have proven to be fabricated. For example, there was a video that came out, someone who said, I am a priest and I was at a church when I was, you know, attacked and we were attacked. The church was attacked by Ethiopian and Eritrean troops. When we found out later, the priest was not a priest, but a young man who lives in Boston, Massachusetts, and works in a hospital. Another very perplexing one was an allegation of massacre at Aksum. The allegation was made that on November 28th and 29th, there was a massacre that happened in the in Aksum, in the city of Aksum. However, the 30th of November, there were thousands and thousands of people in Aksum celebrating Mariam Tsion. Mariam Tsion is a major holiday for the Ethiopian Orthodox and Eritrean Orthodox too, as well, believers. And had there been a massacre to the extent that was said, there was no way that thousands of people in Aksum would be celebrating without being walking all over corpses. So the dates were, I guess, reported wrong, and Amnesty International made a comment towards that. However, it's not the date that was wrong. It was something that was created to give social media the wrong narrative. There were also fake pictures posted by TPLF followers. They posted pictures saying that there's a church that was bombed in by Eritrean troops in Tigray. However, that church was a church that was bombed by TPLF in 2002, and it was posted and circulated in 2002, showing what the TPLF was doing and the atrocities.
Due to time constraint, you can listen to the entire program on Africa World Now Project's SoundCloud. Just search Africa World Now Project. That's it for Africa World Now Project for this week. I would like to thank you for joining us today and look forward to spending time with you next week. We can be reached through all your regular social media platforms. Email africaworldnowproject@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter at AFWRLDNWPRJ. Instagram at Africa World Now Project. Access to our other media platforms can be reached through the bios of our social media. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. The Africa World Now Project Collective consists of international media journalist, executive producer, and human rights activist, Moise Muntali, Africa World Now Project media correspondent, Funa Ngonda, senior research, content contributor, and production director, Dr. Tasneem Siddiqui, senior research, content contributor, and production associate, Dr. Josh Myers, associate producer and content contributor, Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, content contributor and filmmaker, Kurt Waterson, technology advisor is Byron Gray of Grayworks Technologies, and creative directors, international creative and artist designer, Tabassum Siddiqui and Judah Pope. Africa World Now Project can be heard every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on WSNC, NPR affiliate and broadcast service of Winston-Salem State University. Programs are archived and available on all podcast platforms. Search Africa World Now Project. Until next week, be safe, be peaceful, and above all, be intelligent. Sonata ninge nela sonata.